Just to say, someone was asking if this material has been written down somewhere. Well, the closest it has is, if you know Tim Keller's book, Center Church, it's just been republished in three little books. I think Zondervan know what they want to there. And the middle volume of those, Tim's asked various people to respond to aspects of that book. And I've responded to the chapter on contextualization, which has some of this stuff in. So it's Tim's exposition and my response, and then Tim re-responds. So you might find that helpful. It's Zondervan. It's just come out in the last few weeks. So it's Center Church in three little books. And you'll find some of this material there. Okay. Now, let's just try and ground this idea of subversive fulfillment a little bit more, maybe using some more simple ways to understand it. Can we meet to 1 Corinthians, chapter 1, verses 18 to 25? This has been very helpful in trying to distill or give a summary of what this idea is. So I think what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1 is then practiced in Acts 17. So Paul here gives the theory in 1 Corinthians, and then we see it acted out in Acts 17. Now, it's a passage you'll be familiar with. Where is the wise man? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since the wisdom of the world through its wisdom did not know him. God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs, Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Paul is saying, firstly, that the message of the cross confronts any other way of viewing the world. It is a scandal. It is the opposite of what people hope for and dream for and desire. The cross of Jesus Christ is a big fat no to the world's way of doing things. So the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel that we proclaim, will always be confrontational at some level. It's always confrontational. And yet, it connects with people as well as confronting them. Here's the thing. If the gospel was just about confrontation, why does Paul bother distinguishing between two types of people? He says, there's some people called Jews and they demand signs, and there's some people called Greeks and they look for wisdom. It's their baseline narratives of understanding culture. It's their hopes, their desires, their aspirations. And Jews, a particular ethnic group of people, they look for one thing, signs, power. Greeks, they look for another thing. They look for wisdom. Jews are not Greeks. Greeks are not Jews. Now, if the gospel is purely confrontational, if we simply preach Christ crucified, who cares what Jews or Greeks think? In fact, who even cares that we should distinguish them? They're just humans. And we preach Christ crucified. It doesn't matter what you think. Now, I think some of us sometimes adopt that approach. We don't need to bother with a cultural engagement. It doesn't really matter where we're coming from, what our ethnic background is, what our culture's hopes and desires and fears are, because we just preach Christ crucified. Blank slate, we just preach. But Paul doesn't do that. Look what he does. Jews demand signs, Greeks look for wisdom. Two groups of people looking for two different things. We preach Christ crucified. Now, in my Bible, in the English here, there's not a full stop. A stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. Yes, the cross confronts both Jews and Greeks. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, look, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Oh, wait a minute, Paul. This is a felt needs gospel. Jews looking for power and signs, and you're now saying Jesus is power? Greeks are looking for wisdom, and you're saying that Jesus is wisdom? Are you going soft? No, because Christ is power. Christ is wisdom in exactly the opposite way that Jews and Greeks expected, but Paul still makes the connection. Christ crucified is contextualized, is communicated to that particular culture in their particular context. So, Christ is the wisdom of God for Greeks. He is the power of God for Jews. So the gospel both confronts and connects at the same time. And again, I'm caricaturing, generalizing, I suppose. Some of us like the confrontation. We find the connection more difficult. Some others, we love the connection, but we don't like the confrontation. And Paul says the gospel does both. That's exactly what Paul was doing at the Areopagus. He connects with those people. Men of Athens, I see you're very religious. What you worship in ignorance, I'm going to proclaim to you. And yet he confronts them as well. So the gospel both subverts, it confronts, but it fulfills. Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of culture in a confrontational way. Do you see? So here's the question. We preach Christ crucified. Jews look for signs. Greeks look for wisdom. Think about the people that you minister to in your country. What do they look for? And how is Christ crucified both confronting them and connecting with them? And that's where we're going to have to be very specific on our situations. Because what looks different in what looks like confrontation and connection in Russia will be very different from Athens, will be very different from Paris, will be very different from Rome. The gospel both confronts and connects at the same time. And that's, I believe, what faithful cultural engagement is about. Now, let's bring all that back to today because we're in a particular context. We're in the European context. Now, how can I say anything, well, one as a Brit talking about Europe with our situation in terms of our relationship with Europe, although I'm a season ticket holder at West Ham United and we have Gustavo Payet, so I love the French at the moment. Dimitri Payet, so we love the French. Brits don't always say that, so let's just make that clear. How do we relate to all of our different subcultures? So I can only give a kind of an overview, and hopefully on your tables you can discuss this a little bit more. What's the situation that we're in at the moment? Well, first of all, let's go back to this idea of plausibility. In your particular context, the gospel will have certain plausibility or probably implausibility. We need to remember that people's doubts about the Christian faith are actually beliefs. Doubts are beliefs. If you disbelieve something about the Christian gospel, you are believing something else. And so we need to understand what those beliefs are to be able to not just refute them, but deconstruct them. So, plausibility is important. Secondly, we need to recognize that the public square is a battleground of the gods, and that people will always fight for their idols and gods, their objects of worship. Now, in a minute, I'm going to tell you the lie that secular modernity has told us about religion. But we know, because we have Bible eyes to see, that everyone worships something. There is no neutrality. And we become like the gods that we worship. The psalm makes that very clear. You become what you worship. Friends, there is no coincidence that if you worship Allah, a monad, oneness, you will want to create a society which stresses uniformity and oneness. You become like the gods that you worship. So when we talk about the public square, we're just talking about a battleground of the gods. It's great that Matt was talking about in terms of Exodus this morning. With the plagues, they refute different gods at every stage. Now, as we look over Europe, and we heard some of the context this morning, what are our responses to the public challenge and threats that people see in Europe? And again, it's embarrassing having to talk about so many different cultures and subcultures. But I would say that there's lots of different responses. Maybe the response to our world and the problems that we have at the moment is that of the principled secularist. And the country closest to that in Europe is still France. It is a principled secularism that is much more kind of hard line than other secular states. Maybe that's the answer. Maybe we just need to get rid of religion, abolish it in some way. Then there's what might be called procedural secularism. I'll be speaking about this. Not that we get rid of religion, but we just have the idea of a neutral public square. Maybe that's the answer. We'll be speaking about that shortly. Then some of your countries will be experiencing a rising conservative nationalism at the moment. The way that we deal with the problems of integration, the way that we deal with social unrest, is that we go back to a time where we have those values where we were all agreed. And the way to do that is through a certain nationalism, a spirit of the people. Again, we see that all over the place. Maybe the answer is that of a radical multiculturalism. We just let people just exist with their different views of life, and they're just so compartmentalized. That's the one that's, especially after recent events, I think that one's not very popular. People realize that there has to be some integration for society to work. And then maybe there's some who think that actually the answer is that of a kind of a neo-Christendom where there was a kind of a general understanding of Christianity that then allowed for things like toleration. Maybe that's the answer, maybe. But these are all very different threats that we face. Let's just concentrate on this idea of secularism or secularisms. I want to focus here because whether you're coming from a Catholic background, an Orthodox background in terms of culture, the virus, I suppose, that is secular humanism, liberal humanism, secularism, is all over the place. This is the biggest challenge, I suppose. The guy who was my PhD supervisor, Professor Gavin DaCosta, professor of Catholic theology at Bristol University, wrote a very good book trying to analyze the situation here. He says this, and he's writing in 2008, in the EU in 2008, the EU is consisted of 27 nation states. It's arguable that they are composed of six significant cultural streams: Greek, Judeo-Christian, Islamic, the Latin West, East, and Byzantine, and in the new EU, and finally, the offspring of the Judeo-Christian heritage, secular modernity. And he says this, secular modernity has nearly succeeded in erasing the previous five layers, although it's entirely dependent on those traditions to explain its own genesis. One might say it's the young son trying to murder his father. I mean, the EU constitution is a great example of that. You think about the influence Christianity has had in Europe, and it's not even mentioned. And so secular modernity has kind of like a virus just spread all over the place. And at the heart of secular modernity, and this is why it's important for our apologetics, is a story. Remember that worldviews work on the function not just of beliefs, but on the issue of a story. Now, what is the story of secular modernity? What's the story it tells about religion? It's this. Religion causes problems. Religion causes bloodshed, and the only way to deal with religion is to privatize it and put it in the private square. It cannot be put into the public square, because when religion and politics and all that stuff gets together, people die. Now, You can be a very sophisticated political philosopher, scientist, and say that, or you can be someone who is not a political scientist, who's just a normal, average person, but they have been told religion causes problems. Therefore, do not bring religion into the public square. Here's what DaCosta says. The religious wars told many Europeans two very important lessons. When religion controlled society, that society was incapable of dealing with religious differences. For it was fundamental to the religious spirit that error should be eliminated. And that meant large numbers of men, women, and children dead. Second, if society ended in bloody conflict when based on conflicting religious allegiances, what should be required was a non-religious, non-partisan form of government that can emerge to secure peace, freedom, tolerance, and prosperity. That's the story that lots of people in Europe go around with. That's why religion has to be dealt with. That's the secular modern worldview. The problem is that it's false, and we need to question that worldview. But we have to question it at that level. Now, DaCosta, in his book, has three ways in which he kind of tries to do this. One, he shows that actually the wars of religion were not about wars of religion at all. They're about the emergence of nation states and many of your country's histories in the last 200, 300 years actually will be wars fought in the name of the nation state rather than in the name of religion. Secondly, it's understanding this idea that it's the sovereign nation state that generates the definition of religion. Here's the key thing, and this is where it kind of it cashes out in some ways. Here's the practical application. That at the end of the day, religious ends for the nation state must fit within the framework of the state's final goals. The question becomes, is there salvation by state or salvation by Christ? And this is the problem that sovereign nation states are facing in Europe at the moment. Sovereign nation states have troubles with people who have more than one loyalty, whether that's looking to the cross of Jesus Christ, whether that's looking to Mecca, because there can only be one sovereign. And that's a problem, because the sovereign state calls for total allegiance. Now, in my context in the UK, it's quite nuanced. David Cameron, our Prime Minister, he has a place for Jesus, no doubt. He has a place for Jesus, but it's not the preeminent Jesus that we worship. It's a Jesus that has to be accommodated to the greater ideals, whatever they might be. Tolerance, however that's defined, sexual freedom, equality. You can have your Jesus as long as it doesn't question those ultimate ends. And you will have the same thing in your countries at the moment. And that's a problem. Now, if you think, what on earth has this got to do with the Bible? Well, of course, this is what the situation that we saw in the first century. Caesar tolerated many local religions and deities. In fact, that's why we need to be loyal to Caesar, because he creates the environment in which we can all worship our own gods. But we have to say that Caesar is Lord. And we cannot say that Caesar is Lord because Jesus Christ is Lord. Do we believe that? And that means we're getting into the situations we are. In England at the moment, it's going through the government at the moment. We have a kind of a terrorism bill going on called the Prevent Duty, which means that there will be a category called non-violent extremism. I am already a non-violent extremist. All of you are. And this means, even at the moment, there are discussions that holiday clubs in churches will have to be inspected by the government to make sure there's no radicalization. That's been discussed at the moment. And it's all to do with these allegiances that people have. Interestingly, the final thing that Gavin DaCosta says here is that actually when you look at people who have died in the name of religion, it's the the 20th and 21st century have been the wars of irreligion. More people have died in the name of irreligion than religion, and the stats are there to prove it. So that's the problem that we have. That modern story that we were talking about is just drunk in by people. Religion's a problem. We need to keep religion out. But it doesn't recognize that we're all religious. We all have ultimate commitments to things. Now, there's two versions of this. I'm not going to go because of for time. If you want to read some of these books, you can do. Two ways in which we see that. One is this idea that actually to talk about anything in the public square, what we need to do is kind of leave our religion and just come and talk about ideals that everyone holds. So we can't talk about comprehensive doctrines in the public square. We must keep religion out, and we can only talk about public reasons for things. The problem with that is that there is no neutrality. Here's what one writer says. Efforts to craft a public square from which religious conversion is absent, no matter how thoughtfully worked out, will always in the end say to those of organized religion that they alone, unlike everyone else, must enter public dialogue only after leaving behind that part of themselves that they may consider most vital. So there's a problem with this idea of liberal modernity, because it's not liberal at all. It's saying you have to become liberal to speak of religious claims. Then there are others who realize that this is kind of inconsistent. These are the kind of, I suppose, the most postmodernists. This guy, Richard Rorty, some of you may have heard of him. He did this great article called Religion as a Conversation Stopper. So the idea is that when you're at a party and someone says, what do you do? And you say you're a minister. He says that kind of cuts the conversation straight away. So he says, look, we have to get on as human beings. The only way that we can do that is just leave out our religious commitments so that we can just carry on in society. Why? Because many of people have an unspoken reaction when we say that we are religious, that we're Christians. They say, so what? We weren't discussing your private life, we're discussing policy. Don't bother us with matters of our concern. But what we need to do is point out that we all have matters of concern. We all have commitments to things. We all have our gods that we worship. Again, what we need to be doing is looking at the world with Bible eyes on. Remember, the public square is a battle of the gods. There is no neutrality. And we need to understand that. So I think that's one understanding of secularism or secularity. The idea that we need to kind of oppose this myth that the public square is a kind of a neutral square. Because it's not working and it's not right either. Now, before we go into our groups, and I've given you some very specific questions about your context here, I just want to point out one more understanding of secularity that might help us. And I'm relying on this book by J.K. Smith, How Not to Be Secular. Now, Smith is a professor of philosophy at Calvin College, and this little book is a commentary on a huge book by a Roman Catholic philosopher called Charles Taylor, called A Secular Faith. But the ideas here, I think, are very important, and they are relevant to us as church planters and leaders here. And I hope this will resonate with us in Europe. If I'm going to give any kind of generalization about the spiritual state of Europe, I think this resonates as much as anything. Smith says this: our secular age is not so much about what people believe or don't believe. Rather, it's about what is believable. So it's not so much that there are less people who believe in the gospel. It's not so much that the stats say that church attendance is down. It's the way that people believe, which is very important to understand. The secular is a new set of conditions for belief. In the year 1500, not believing in God was abnormal. How did we move from a place where in Europe belief in God was not to believe in God was inconceivable, to now believing that God is just one option amongst many and not even the easiest one? How do we get to that situation? And in this sense, Smith and Taylor argue, this is how we live in a secular age. Even when we do see religious participation has been visible and fervent, whether it's evangelical Christianity or Islam, the general wash, the general overview is of the secular, where religion is contestable and contested. This is the point we need to understand. We know it's very easy to get to forget history. The situation we have now is unlike any situation we've had. Religion is contestable and contested. Now, why is this important to us? This is for us to provoke discussion. Because the point is this. We all live in a secular age. We cannot simply say the secular is out there and we are in here. We are not secular. No, the question is, we have all been affected by secularism. The question is, how do we navigate authentic gospel faith in that secularism? We all live with tensions in one way or another. So we need to move from understanding secularism out there to understanding this is the kind of the culture that we all breathe. And a key mark of life in this secular age is the idea that we are not at ease. There's dis-ease. And there's disorientation. Now, this is so important for those who are coming to faith and who we want to disciple. The nature of faith, almost, the conditions of faith are so much more fragile than they used to be because of the implausibility of Christianity. Charles Taylor talks about the fact that we're cross-pressured. There's so many pressures. And that belief is fragile, what he calls fragilization, fragile. And so we have people who don't believe in God, but still recognize there's something about the human person that there must be more to it. There's a writer, Julian Barnes, who wrote a book on his atheism, really. Nothing to Be Afraid Of, it's called. And he starts his book by saying this, and this I think sums up a lot of secular people. I don't believe in God, but I miss him. I don't believe in God, but I miss him. You see, what this view of secularity helps us with is it's too simple just to say, oh, people don't believe in religion anymore, religion's outdated. Because we know as human beings, we're made as God's image bearers. And our kind of our desire to worship always has to show itself somewhere. And so we do see, you know, for all the Richard Dawkins or the Christopher Hitchens or name the atheist associated with your country, there's lots more people who have got no time for hardcore atheism. They don't believe Christianity, but there's something about them. They still ask questions about life. As one writer says, the secular is haunted. Now, why am I saying this? Because we need to recognize where those points of contact are. It might be that we're talking to people and we think on the outside, they have absolutely nothing in common with what I would want to say about life, the universe, and everything. But that's, friends, where we need to back our anthropology. We are made in God's image. Paul says, men of Athens, I see that you're religious. He's not condoning their idolatry, but he recognizes this is a way in. We can't just live in a world and believe that this is all that there is. And so in our films that we watch, in what we read, in novels, on the television, there's so many opportunities to see how people who have no time for God still are searching. And for Taylor, that's what the secular means. You see how it's a more sophisticated kind of way of understanding the secular than simply saying, oh, people did go to church and now they don't go to church. People did believe, now they don't believe. No, people believe differently. And that's the key thing. That's what encourages us to in our evangelism, because people do believe, but they believe differently. And so, at those points, what do we have to do? Confront and connect. Confront and connect. Let me give one example. One example. This idea of feeling disorientated but carrying on regardless. We live in a culture of contradictions, don't we? And this is where technology comes in, I suppose. We feel more anxious as a culture or as cultures, but we've got more answers than we ever had, but we still feel more anxious. We have more access to information, but we're less sure we have the right answer. You know, I can Google and say, where are the best restaurants in Rome to go to? And I'll have six answers, but I know that there'll at least be one bad review for one of the best restaurants. So I'm completely paralyzed. I don't know what to do. That's what technology does. We have so much choice. But there's that idea of disorientation. We don't know who to trust anymore. And that applies to religious belief as well. We were talking about it at our table the other night, or somewhere. Almost consumer evangelicalism. There's so many gospel churches I could go to. There's so many podcasts I could listen to. If I'm not happy at my church, I'll just go somewhere else. And so what do we do? Well, we have this idea, don't we? We just have to carry on regardless in our disorientation. And I suppose that is, I might say, welcome to the secular age. And so you're dealing with people who are coming to faith in Christ, genuine, authentic, Holy Spirit-producing, regenerating hearts. I'm not denying any of that. But they're coming as fragile people who have had a life that's been pressured from all kinds of different ways of viewing the world. And we just need to be aware of that in our discipleship of them. And that might change the way that we look at discipleship or the way that we might do evangelism. And these are some of the things I want you to discuss in your tables. What does living in a secular age mean for our evangelism, for our discipleship? So everyone has this sense that there's a better world, a sense of fullness, but we realize that there's disorientation. And so what happens is, I suppose, people try and make a life in the middle. They try and stabilize their lives. But that doesn't work. People are made in the image of God. We're made for relationship. So people's lives thrive on trust. I think lots of us do want to trust people. I mean, for all the suspicion of authority, there's something in us that wants to trust. We want to trust people. We're nostalgic for days when we could let our kids play out on the streets and it was okay. A day when we were safe to go to the airport and not worry about bombings. We long for those days. And yet we're perpetually confronted with stories of adults abusing trust, letting other people who let us down, and we can't trust anyone. And so many people today have what might be called a guarded trust. It's probably statistically safer than it's ever been to live in Europe, and yet we're obsessed with security and safety. We're always aware of the way that any other institution or person lets us down, and yet we long to trust someone. Now, friends, in that narrative, if the gospel of Jesus Christ cannot connect with that and cannot confront that, then there's something wrong about the way that we are communicating the gospel. But these are people who would never think about God or Jesus or any of that stuff. But they're religious people. And so what we can do in our confrontation, in our connection, is to say, yes, we are made in God's image. God is a good God. But something has gone wrong. There is massive disorientation, which ultimately results in death, the biggest sense of disorientation there is. And you might want to hold to the middle, but there's no place to stand. And the gospel offers new life through the disorientation of death, through the cross, and to the fullness of better life that's any better than any dream that you could think of. Now, what we're doing there is we're connecting and confronting, connecting the gospel, connecting Christ crucified to the stories, the narratives that people are telling themselves. People who are secular. You don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to be religious to talk about people's religion. You don't have to talk about Christianity to talk about Christ in that sense. So these are some of the questions that I want you to discuss in your tables. I've given you two sets of questions from the first section and the second section. Please take these ideas and just run with them. It's fine to disagree. This is one of the points of, you know, you might say, actually, I don't agree with this. I don't agree with this analysis. Great. Discuss it in the tables. That's why we're here. But I hope that's given you a kind of an outline of a cultural engagement and engaging in Europe. Thank you.